Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Mario Ritter and Brian Lynn. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, more Nigerian schoolgirls have been reported missing after the Boko Haram extremist group attacked a school in the northeastern state of Yobe. People with knowledge of the incident said 91 students did not appear in class when teachers made the roll call on Tuesday. The disappearance has raised fears of another mass kidnapping by Boko Haram. The terror group took 276 girls from the school in the village of Chibok in April 2014. That kidnapping sparked worldwide anger and led to the formation of the Bring Back Our Girls movement. Nearly 4 years later, more than 100 of the Chibok girls are still missing. Fearing a repeat of the Chibok kidnappings, parents and guardians gathered Wednesday at the Government Girls Science Secondary School in the town of Dapchi, demanding information. An uncle of one missing student said, "Our girls have been missing for 2 days, and we don't know their whereabouts." A witness from the village of Gumsa said, "I saw girls crying and wailing in three Tata vehicles, and they were crying for help." Witnesses told Reuters Boko Haram militants arrived in Dapchi Monday evening in trucks, some armed with heavy guns. They said the militants immediately went to the school, firing their guns. The witnesses also said that Nigerian security forces launched a search and rescue mission shortly after. Nigerian police and the Regional Education Ministry have denied the kidnappings happened. The State Ministry of Education also denied the kidnappings. However, they closed the school for a week to permit students and their families to reunite. Boko Haram began its rebellion in 2009 and has had a very harmful effect on the communities in northeastern Nigeria. The group has taken thousands of women and young girls, as well as boys and men old enough to fight. In addition, more than 20,000 people have been killed and 2 million others, mostly from the Borno State area, have been forced to leave their homes. Another 200,000 Nigerians have taken refuge in neighboring states. The charity Doctors Without Borders says hundreds of thousands of people who have been forced to rural areas of Borno are now totally dependent on outside aid for survival.
News reports suggest that the Vatican and China could reach an agreement on the appointment of Chinese Catholic religious officials. The goal is to end the split between state-controlled Catholic churches and so-called underground churches that obey the Pope. The Italian newspaper Corriere della Sera reported earlier this week that a Chinese delegation would visit Rome next month. Among those in the delegation would be China's deputy foreign minister. However, some Catholics are concerned about such an agreement. They say a deal would normalize relations between the Vatican and China without dealing with the division between official and unofficial churches in China. Jonathan Liu is a priest with the Chinese Christian Fellowship based in San Francisco, California. He says the agreement will do more harm than good for the independence of Catholics in China. Liu said, "If the Pope demands worshipers to unconditionally obey the agreement, there will be a great deal of conflict. Therefore, I don't think the unjustified agreement will bring unity." He described the agreement as spiritual torture to Chinese Catholics. And he said that it would be considered, in his words, a betrayal by members of the underground church movement. The Chinese government cut relations with the Vatican in 1951. Catholics can only legally attend state-controlled Catholic churches. Church leaders, such as bishops in the state-controlled churches, are appointed by the Chinese government rather than the Vatican. Underground churches, however, say they are loyal to the Pope. Anthony Lean is an expert on the Catholic Church in China. He estimated that the country's Catholic population decreased to 10.5 million in 2016. However, ties between the Vatican and the Chinese government have improved under Pope Francis. In January, the Vatican asked two underground bishops working in China to be replaced by two who were approved by China. Joseph Chen is a retired cardinal, a top church official. He has criticized the improving relations between the Vatican and the Chinese government. He wrote that the talks with Chinese officials would only give control of the Catholic Church in China to the government. Chen, who also is the former bishop of Hong Kong, said that talks between the sides had not been equal. He said he had heard reports that China refused to discuss Bishop James Su. Chen said Su had been in the hands of the Chinese government for more than 20 years. Accepting their refusal is like kneeling down to them from the outset, he said. However, supporters of the effort to improve ties do not agree. Francesco Sisi, a former Italian diplomat, is now a researcher at China Renmin University. He said a deal does not hurt the principles of the Holy See, the government of the Catholic Church in the Vatican. Instead, he said, the move could be a way to bridge what he called gaps between China and the rest of the world. He noted that the world's 230 cardinals, except Chen, and all bishops in China have agreed with the Pope's decision. Hans Stockton is director of the Center for International Studies at the University of St. Thomas in the U.S. state of Texas. He says the Catholic Church is weighing the good and the harm of making a deal with China. In negotiations, China is expected to seek formal diplomatic ties with the Vatican. However, Stockton notes that such a move would hurt Taiwan, which could lose the Vatican as an ally. China considers the self-ruling island a rebel province. some Chinese have criticized the agreement on social media. They say China will be the winner in talks if the government gets to nominate candidates for bishop. I'm Mario Ritter.
The United States won its first Olympic medal in a men's luge singles event at the Pyeongchang Winter Olympics. Chris Masder won a silver medal last week, equaling the best finish ever for any member of the U.S. Olympic luge team. In the past, American Olympians won bronze and silver medals in women's singles and men's doubles luge. Over the years, German and Austrian teams have dominated the sport. When those teams lost, other European nations won. In the luge, competitors lie flat, feet first, on a small sled. They can travel around an icy track at speeds up to 140 kilometers an hour. The riders control the sled's speed by changing the position of their feet or by moving their shoulders. So why did Team USA luge win a medal at the Pyeongchang Olympics? Most credit must go to Chris Masder himself. The American said his win was a product of 16 years of preparation and intense training. His teammate and training partner, Taylor Morris, called him an animal whose years of hard work clearly paid off in the end. But another reason for Masder's success could have been 3D printer technology, which his team used to make its equipment. The term 3D is short for three-dimensional, meaning an object with length, width, and height. In 3D printing, 3D models are first created as files or documents on a computer. The printer then uses a substance like plastic or metal to create physical objects. The process involves making one layer of material at a time until the objects reach full form. The USA luge team worked with an American company called Stratasys on the design and manufacturing process for the sleds. First, the company made a scan, or image, of the body of every member of the luge team. Then, 3D printing technology was used to create tools for making molds in the shape of Olympians on top of a sled. The process of designing and tooling sled parts is highly complex and can take several weeks. Officials from USA Luge say 3D printing can greatly simplify the process, speeding up production of parts to within hours. Gordy Shear is the marketing director for USA Luge. He says 3D printing works well for making last-minute changes that require exactness. As we learn more about aerodynamics and optimizing our designs, it's nice to be able to have the ability to make those changes quickly, Shear said. The head of technical programs for USA Luge, John Owen, says the use of 3D printing has made the team more competitive. It helps the team continuously adjust designs and run them on the track much faster than traditional processes, he said. He added that the technology also provides a way to perfectly fit each rider to the sled, while cutting production time and costs. Other sports represented at the 2018 Olympics have used 3D printing to improve their equipment. Snowboard maker Capita used 3D printers to build stronger sidewalls for its snowboards. The process, called Fuse 3D, connects a plastic sidewall to the wooden center of the board. The technology even won a Product of the Year award from an international sports organization. 3D printing company Materialize makes form-fitted insides for ski boots. It uses a scan of a person's foot to produce perfectly fit boot inserts within a matter of minutes. I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In October of 1859, a group of anti-slavery extremists attacked the town of Harper's Ferry. Harper's Ferry was part of Virginia then. Today, it is located in West Virginia. The attackers were led by John Brown. They seized a gun factory and a federal supply center where military equipment was kept. They planned to use the guns and equipment to organize a rebel army of slaves. Harry Monroe and Kay Gallant tell us what happened to John Brown after he seized Harper's Ferry.
The President of the United States in 1859 was James Buchanan. When Buchanan learned of the attack, he wanted immediate action. He sent a force of Marines to Harper's Ferry under the command of Army Colonel Robert E. Lee. John Brown had attacked with about 20 men. Several, including two of his sons, had been killed by local militia. He and his remaining men withdrew to a small brick building. The attack had failed. Not one slave had come to Harper's Ferry to help Brown. The few whom his men had freed had refused to fight when the shooting started. Brown could not understand the fear that kept the slaves from fighting for their freedom.
Brown and his men were trapped inside the brick building. They held a few hostages whom they hoped to exchange for their freedom. Colonel Lee wrote a message to John Brown demanding his surrender. He did not think Brown would surrender peaceably, so he planned to attack as soon as Brown rejected the message. He felt this was the surest way to save the lives of the hostages. As expected, Brown refused to surrender. He said he and his men had the right to go free. As soon as Brown spoke, the signal was given. The Marines attacked. They broke open a small hole in the door of the brick building. One by one, the Marines moved through the hole. They fought hand to hand against the men inside. After a brief fight, they won. John Brown's rebellion was crushed.
A few hours after Brown was captured, the governor of Virginia and three congressmen arrived in Harper's Ferry. They wanted to question Brown. Brown had been wounded in the final attack. He was weak from the loss of blood, but he welcomed the chance to explain his actions. The officials first asked where Brown got the money to organize his raid. Brown said he raised most of it himself. He refused to give the names of any of his supporters. Then the officials asked why Brown had come to Harper's Ferry. "We came to free the slaves," Brown said, "and only that." He continued, "I think that you are guilty of a great wrong against God and humanity. I believe anyone would be perfectly right to interfere with you so far as to free those you wickedly hold in slavery. I think I did right. You had better, all you people of the South, prepare yourselves for a settlement sooner than you are prepared for it. You may get rid of me very easily. I am nearly gone now. But this question is still to be settled. This Negro question, I mean. That is not yet ended."
The raid on Harper's Ferry increased the bitterness of the national dispute over slavery. Members of the Democratic Party called the raid a plot by the Republican Party. Republican leaders denied the charge. They said the raid was the work of one man, one madman, John Brown. Still, they said, he had acted for good reason, to end slavery in America. Southern newspapers condemned Brown. Some said his raid was an act of war. Some demanded that he be executed as a thief and murderer. Many Southerners said all of the North was responsible for the raid. They believed all Northerners wanted a slave rebellion in the South. And it was such a rebellion that Southerners feared more than anything else. New measures were approved throughout the South to prevent this. Military law was declared in some areas. Slave owners threatened to beat or hang any Negro who even looked rebellious.
The fear of a slave rebellion united the people of the South. For years, rich slave owners had talked of taking the Southern states out of the Union to save their way of life. But those who had no slaves opposed the idea of disunion. John Brown's raid changed that. After his attack on Harper's Ferry, the South spoke with one voice. All Southerners declared that they would fight to protect their homes from a Negro rebellion or from another attack by men like Brown. Feelings were especially high in Virginia, the state in which the raid took place. Virginians wanted Brown punished quickly to show what would happen to anyone who tried to lead a Negro rebellion. There was some question whether Brown should be tried in a federal court or a state court. Brown's raid took place within the borders of a state, but the property he seized belonged to the federal government. The governor of Virginia decided to try Brown in a state court. He believed a federal court trial would take too long. If Brown were not brought to trial quickly, he said, people might attack the jail and kill him.
Brown was being held in Charlestown, a few kilometers from Harper's Ferry. The court there named two lawyers to defend him. A doctor examined Brown. He reported that Brown's wounds were not serious enough to prevent the trial from starting. Brown lay in a bed in the courtroom throughout the trial. John Brown's lawyers tried to show that his family had a history of madness. They tried to prove that Brown, too, was mad. They asked the court to declare him innocent because of insanity. Brown protested. He said the lawyers were just trying to save his life. He did not want such a defense. The matter of insanity was dropped.
Brown's lawyers then argued that he was not guilty of the three crimes with which he was charged. First, they said, he could not be guilty of treason against Virginia because he was not a citizen of Virginia. Second, he could not be guilty of plotting a slave rebellion because he had never incited slaves against their owners. And third, he could not be guilty of murder, because he had killed only in self-defense. The trial lasted 5 days. The jury found John Brown guilty of all three charges.
The judge asked Brown if he wanted to make a statement before being sentenced. Brown did. He declared that he had not planned to start a slave rebellion. He said he only wanted to free some slaves and take them to Canada. Brown's statement was strong, but it was not true. He had, in fact, planned to organize an army of slaves to fight for their freedom. He acted in the belief that slaves throughout the South would rise up against their owners and join him. Brown's words did not move the judge. He said he could find no reason to question the jury's decision that Brown was guilty. He sentenced Brown to be hanged.
One of Brown's supporters attempted to find a way to free Brown from jail. Several plans were proposed. None were tried. Brown himself did not want to escape. He said he could do more to destroy slavery by hanging than by staying alive. John Brown was executed on December 2nd, 1859. His death created a wave of public emotion throughout the country. In the North, people mourned. One man wrote, "The events of the last month or two have done more to build Northern opposition to slavery than anything which has ever happened before, than all the anti-slavery pamphlets and books that have ever been written." In the South, people cheered, but their happiness at Brown's punishment was mixed with anger at those who honored him. As the nation prepared for a presidential election year, the South renewed its promise to defend slavery or leave the Union.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.